Okay, so I'm going to be talking about the transcription of prosody, not the state of the art, but rather how much we can recover from archival materials. So I'm going to be looking at intonation in Kadook and comparing transcriptions by the two linguists that we have the bulk of archival materials from. And we'll discuss findings, some questions that are raised by what we found, and some applications of this research. So to give a little background on the language that we'll be discussing, Kadook is a highly endangered language of Northern California. Currently, only a handful of first language speakers remain, but there's an ongoing revitalization effort in the tribe, and so we have estimated 20 to 50 language learners and L2 users. We have actually a wealth of archival material on Kadook. In particular, there is a great deal of material recorded in the 1920s by J.P. Harrington, including some published texts, several reels of microfilm, and there's one surviving recording from this era. And in the more recent period, we have a grammar published by William Bright, and we also have approximately 3 hours of recordings that he made, and his field notes are archived as well. So, why is prosody important? It's really crucial in learning to speak a language, but it can be really elusive. So it's something that is hard to explain to someone who's learning language, and it's hard to acquire when you're learning language, but it's really important to sound fluent. It's also, of course, important linguistically. In syntax, it is particularly useful in looking at otherwise puzzling word order patterns, and also in word level accentuation. In Kadook in particular, there are some variable patterns that we want to understand better. And so when you're in a situation where you want to learn or learn about a language, but most of the material that you have is archival material, it's really difficult to recover prosody from these materials without any audio, because it's often not explicitly transcribed or it's transcribed differently. So the question is whether we can interpret these archival transcriptions at all to obtain linguistically useful data on prosody. Is this a crazy idea to even try to do this? So let's think for a minute about what we do when we write prosody every day. So if you say these sentences to yourself, you probably have a pretty good idea of how they would be pronounced in your dialect of American English, because we use punctuation as a shorthand. Just like with orthography, you know, we don't write every phonetic detail when we're writing the language. And of course, there is a more precise system for transcribing prosody, but it's not, which would be analogous to the IPA for transcribing the sounds, the segments. But of course, this isn't practical for everyday use with language teaching. But this is often how it is, how prosody is transcribed in the archival record in our field notes. And so, in any case, we still need that knowledge about how the intonation system works to interpret the punctuation that we see. We don't want to just superimpose English patterns on the Kadook that we have based on the punctuation that we see. So with this in mind, we want to look at what are those intonational patterns associated with the punctuation that we see in the archival record. So to restate the question a little more specifically, we want to find out whether we can extract useful utterance level prosodic data from the archival materials that we have, and find out what degree, to what degree can we correlate the Bright and Harrington materials. And the methodology that we use to do this is to take historic recordings that we have the both the audio and the transcriptions for, and compare them. Okay, so kind of accent is a whole other topic, but suffice it to say that there is at most one accent per word in Kadook, and you'll see it written with an acute or circumflex accent. So I'll play this example sentence. So a typical intonational phrase in Kadook is characterized by a gradual rise to a peak. Pitch peak, followed by an abrupt fall. And the pitch peak typically coincides with the last accent in the word. The end of an utterance is characterized by devoicing, glottalization, or other accent effects, depending on the syllables that are present. So, in Wright's transcriptions, interestingly, he actually uses punctuation explicitly to transcribe intonational contours. So he says that the punctuation that he uses indicates intonational contour of the preceding sequence of words, and it is not reflecting the syntax, but rather the emotions of the speaker. So the period, exclamation point, and semicolon marks represent utterances. The period associated with a rising falling pitch contour like we saw in the previous slide, and this is the unmarked emotional intonation. The exclamation point being associated with a higher register and a semicolon with the falling intonation are, according to Wright, representing excitement and sadness, respectively, on the part of the speaker. The comma is used at the edge of, so it also is associated with an unmarked emotional state, and it's used, my interpretation of this is at the right edge of an accentual phrase, but not utterance finally, so it is associated with a weak, low boundary tone, at the delineating an accentual phrase that isn't an entire utterance. The intonational contours of Kanuk actually translate quite well into a system such as Tobi. The Japanese version of this system can be adapted quite well to Kanuk. There are a lot of similarities in the intonational patterns. So just for a couple of examples, I would write a word accent in Kanuk with the high star plus L. I'll play this clip for you. This is a very long sentence, and I'll play it again. So here, there is a pause in the middle, and you see that it goes low, but not as low as the final low. And so this break, I think Wright would call a comma pause, and I would write with a weak, low boundary tone. And the final low at the end, I would write with a low boundary tone, corresponding to a more significant break between the two intonational phrases than the earlier one. So then, turning to Harrington, we only have one recording from this era. This is a recording made of Phoebe Maddox in the 20s, so basically a generation earlier than the speakers that Wright was working with. And in general, the intonation seems quite comparable to that described by Wright. So I'll play a clip from this. So we see that, again, we have a gradual rise to a peak followed by a fall, and you get the same right edge utterance final effects. The actual intonational contour is variable based on factors such as what words are in the utterance and the context, but this, you also find this in the right materials. But overall, we can see this is the same language with the same basic intonational patterns. Here's an example of the transcription by Harrington. We have the notes and a typescript of this particular text. We don't have a published version of it. So what are the different types of punctuation that Harrington uses in his transcriptions? Sentences are marked with periods, reflect utterances. In some cases, we found that the Kanuk was split into more sentences than the English free translation, so that was something that I looked into. Quotes are introduced with colons. And there are occasional mismatches between the notes in the TypeScript in where he changed commas or semicolons to periods. And so we find that utterances are, in fact, recoverable from his transcriptions, although the detailed variation among intonational contours that Wright discusses are not generally recoverable. So just to look at some of Harrington's transcriptions in more detail, we have what I'm going to call a basic sentence. So when he uses a period, this is correlates with there's a clear pause after the utterance, and you have the rise to the peak with a low fall and debarsing and glottalization at the right edge that we saw earlier. Here's a case where he actually changed the English free translation, but the Carrick transcription remained the same. So this is interesting because it actually tells us that his understanding of the meaning of the Carrick changed. So it seems that he originally thought that it was the same subject in both sentences, and then in working with his consultant, he realized that it was actually a different subject, so it didn't make sense to have it one sentence in English. But the fact that it was transcribed all along as two separate utterances in the Carrick indicates that these are really, he's indicating that these are units in the Carrick, and that's stable. So there's a real clear pause between those, and you have D voicing here at the end of the first utterance. We also see formulaic sentences, which are traditional ways of beginning and ending myths. These follow the same general contour as basic sentences, but the pauses between them can be very abbreviated, which makes sense if this is something that you say in this particular format every time you tell one of these stories. So looking at his use of commas, there's actually very few examples of these in the text that we have. So it's hard, not really enough to say anything definitive about intonation. Most of these have some unusual intonation, but in general it does appear that a comma indicates the right edge of an accentual phrase, because you do have a low. So this is unusual in being very low and slow, and it's very expressive of, she's, I think, accentuating how hard she was dancing. So the question is whether there are also cases where Harrington would have preposed or postposed material that he doesn't write with a comma, that Bright would write with a comma. So that's something that I'd like to look at more. Then we also have a case where Harrington changed his mind and started out with a comma or a semicolon in the transcription, and then in the revised transcription that we see in the typescript, he wrote it as two separate utterances. So here's one of these. So in these, it's always going from multiple phrases in the notes to multiple sentences in the typescript. And it does seem to me that in these cases, this certainly seems like the end of an utterance. There's a clear pause afterwards. You have devoicing at the end of the first piece. And more so than, you see there's also a pause here, but this doesn't sound as final after aim. So it seems that there's a definite break here. So I'm not sure what to make of the fact that he wrote it with a comma initially, or a semicolon rather. But it does seem like it's been revised so that the Carrick actually represents utterances. So that does seem to be consistent. So to review what we've seen in the two systems, Bright has three different ways of transcribing utterances. Harrington would use a period to cover all of these specific utterance specific intonational contours. For smaller intonational phrases within an utterance, Bright will mark that with a comma. It seems Harrington can either mark that with a comma or leave it unmarked. And I didn't talk about quotes here. We can talk about that later if you're interested. We have, with Bright, he'll use either a comma or nothing, depending on whether there's finality before the quote begins. Harrington uses colons here, and they both use quote marks to indicate the quoted speech. So to sum up what we found, yes, we do find that we can recover useful information from the archival transcriptions, especially for utterances. We see that in the Harrington, using the Kadu transcription correlates with utterances, although of course we can't recover everything. We can't recover some of the finer detail about the intonational contours themselves from Harrington's transcriptions that we can get from the Bright transcriptions. We also find that the same basic intonational contour is by far the most common in both of the recordings. So we know that the rise to the peak and then the late fall seems to be an unmarked intonational contour in both sets of recordings. And where the Harrington and the Bright differ actually raises some interesting questions. So some of these open questions are, we do actually find Bright's so-called expressive contours in the Harrington. So we do find utterances that have a raised pitch register and that have a falling intonation throughout, but in somewhat different contexts from those that Bright describes. So not, they don't really seem to be associated with sadness or excitement, but rather with information structure. So this raises all sorts of interesting questions about things to look at in information structure in these texts. There's also a question of individual variation or style. So I had noticed that in the text that I was looking at recorded by Bright, the speaker tended to have a higher register when she was quoting, but I didn't find this in the Harrington. So it's a question whether it's just that particular speaker or possibly a generational difference. So I want to look at some more recordings from the Bright era to see whether anyone else does that higher register shift. Finally, there is some inconsistency when you actually look at the phonetic transcriptions of what Bright was transcribing, sorry, in the phonetic contours. So for instance, he talks about always the pitch peak always being late in the sentence, but sometimes when you look at the actual contour, there is an early peak that's just slightly higher phonetically than the late one. So this is something that, I mean, overall it sounds like what he's talking about. You still have the rise and the fall, but this is worth looking at in a little more detail, especially regarding the circumflex accent, whether it's maybe a higher high than some of the other accents. Then also the things that Bright transcribes as commas, when you actually look at them, they're not quite as consistent as he makes out with whether it goes low or the edge effects are not always totally consistent. And so what some of the applications of this research for pedagogy are that, of course, Kadook utterance prosody is quite different from that of English, and so it has to be learned. So this is a pedagogical challenge, teaching people how to read the punctuation of these older materials, what that means, and also just in, you know, normal, someone's writing, writing down Kadook, how would you interpret that punctuation in a way that sounds Kadook? What would be the correct intonational contours? And so we actually found that we can identify a typical utterance contour, and this can be the baseline for learning and teaching, and something that we can build off of when we know more about information structure and what are some of the other less common intonational contours. We also have applications within syntax. Having this material lets us test hypotheses about what determines word order in Kadook. So some of these include that postverbal positioning of complement clauses is governed by prosody, or that extra position of non-initial conjuncts is governed by prosody, and that there are two distinct postverbal positions for DPs. So thank you, and thanks to our all the Kadook elders and ancestors that have worked to record the language, and for our supporters and helpers. Go with that.
base prosodic structure was, what is that?
So I think the structure where you have, you start out in the middle pitch range and kind of gradually rise to a peak towards the end of the utterance, then this drastic fall at the right edge of the utterance. You know, I think if we could show a lot of examples of that and help people sort of hear that contour, that seems like a really basic thing that happens a lot of the time. That would be something that people could model, you know, unmarked sentences on.
I was just struck by the sentence that had the aim in it. Could that be interpreted as for her, she da da da?
Let me look at that one. Yes, this is interesting in a lot of ways. I don't know if you have anything to add to this thing with it.
Well, means doctor, so it's not the subject, it's not she.
Ah.
It's the first predicate.
Yeah, so I should go through this. So
she's thinking, or?
So this is, she also there lived, Lu Jie, doctor, and sorcerer. So.
Is it contrastive?
Is which part contrastive?
Sorry, the marked intonation on E, whether that's doing contrastive or like a switch reference type function. Oh no, we're talking about Lu Jie.
Yeah, I don't think I would say it's contrastive. It could be focused. I mean, this is the first time that she's being introduced as a doctor. But because this has a circumflex accent, it's going to have that high-low anyway. Lev.
So I just wanted to clarify something. So is the purpose of this principally or exclusively to allow readers to get the right intonation contours for the texts, or are there other goals as well?
I mean, I guess the initial inspiration for looking at this was the syntactic questions. And then that kind of developed into, well, you know, what's actually going on in these transcriptions? And it seems like this could also have applications for pedagogy.
So with respect to that first question, I mean, this is sort of a smart alecky question, but why not just use your recordings and forget about interpreting, doing this complex interpretation on these texts? Is there a reason why these texts are, I suppose they're already written down.
Just looking at the vast volume of material that we already have written down, it'd be great to make use of that.
Sure.
We, of course, also want to make use of recordings and the modern recordings. But you know, this is sort of looking backwards, but also looking forwards. There's a question of whether there have been changes in these patterns in the context of language attrition. And so it's nice to be able to compare the recordings that we have made. And because you know, there is some reduction in complexity of morphology. So it would be interesting to see whether there is English influence. But yeah, I mean, it would just be nice to make use of all these archival materials.
And maybe if I can add one thing to that, there's also a certain, the syntactic richness of the earlier recorded and transcribed material is greater than in the modern day speakers that we work with. So there's certain kinds of complex syntactic constructions that have never come up with the speakers we work with, but that are robustly attested in the archival material. So that's one reason wanting to use the better.
So I have mostly worked with a teacher who is working with both kids and adults. Most of the people that she's teaching are at a pretty basic level. So they're probably not thinking about this type of thing at this point. And I forgot the other part of your question. Whether they're
interested in this sort of question.
Oh, with the using the
and
earlier materials.
They're specifically interested in using archival materials.
Yeah, I mean, we have a lot of these stories digitized and online. And I think especially the things that have audio, people are really interested in using. So of course, things that have audio are the most are the most useful. But I think people look at the other transcribed stuff as well.
Maybe if I could add to that, there are some very advanced L2 learners who've expressed an interest in these things. And also from the beginning, when we started working maybe 5 years ago, one of the first issues that came up and comes up again and again is word order, how to make your sentence sound better, because word order is grammatically free. And so this is just one type of way of getting at that question, which is very much in people's mind, and just ask, how should I order the things? And so yeah, that's an indirect application.
Have you thought about how you actually go about teaching intonation to people who don't have any of the jargon for talking about intonation?
Not really.
Do you have suggestions?
No, I'd love to. I mean, I do have some, but I'm making it up as I go. I'd love to hear other people make it up and collect good ideas.
I've heard in a few cases, both for doing field work and you know, correctly capturing and verifying with your speaker that you have intonation directives right, and for teaching to hum an utterance.
So I can say that we tried humming in work with Cherokee, and there were a number of people who didn't particularly care to hum, and it then became somewhat of an issue. We could never ask mention humming anymore. So it is a great idea, and it's a wonderful thing to do. And then if you ask somebody who's an elder and decides that they don't want to hum, no one else wants to hum either. But it also takes a certain personality. I mean, some things take personalities to do, and some people would be perfect for that.
Definitely.
No, so I want good idea. I thought you might have lots of ideas that I could steal.
Not yet, but I think that this is obviously something that is ripe for a lot of brainstorming and trying new things out. So
we'll
see what we come up with.
One thought on that. So I work with teachers that work in the TPRS methodology, and it's all about just lots and lots of repetitive input through stories, so that people stay interested and care about what's being said. And we find that about maybe a third of the students do start to take on the intonation, and but it takes that much repetition. They have to keep hearing it. But the other thing is when it's through interaction that they're hearing is over and over. If they say something that just doesn't make sense conversationally, then the teacher can say, like, I'm not sure what you mean. And then they have to use the intonation to convey what they're trying to say, which is a little different from if you have total learner autonomy with the students in their own groups. They're going to continue using their own English intonation and understanding each other just fine, which doesn't force them to use the intonation that the target is.
Yeah.